You're listening to the Young Opportunist Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode. We're lucky enough to have our good friend Ravi Sharma back on the show today. And honestly, I don't think this could have come at a better time, given the current economic climate and the worries about the housing market crash.
Ravi currently leads one of Australia's fastest growing buyers agency called Search Property. He has also accumulated a personal real estate portfolio well over $4.5 million, which was achieved all before he turned 30. Ravi also has a YouTube channel where he educates young people about real estate investing, cryptocurrency, and financial freedom. So we're going to link his channel in the description below. So what do we actually cover in this episode?
So we cover Ravi's thoughts on whether we're going into a recession and the housing crisis, whether you should be buying or selling in this type of environment, what rising inflation and interest rates mean for you, what strategies work during a downturn in the market,
why the cash in your bank is buying you less every day, and finally, we couldn't help but touch on a little bit on the crypto market, including lessons learned in the market over the past 2 years, because it's been a crazy ride.
With every man and their dog talking about the state of the Australian real estate market, and with the media pumping out millions of different narratives, it's important to choose wisely about who you listen to. So this episode is really for everyone.
With all that said, let's get underway with today's episode. Welcome back to another episode, guys. We are now at episode 24, and today we have the absolute honor to welcome back Ravi Sharma. If you haven't listened to episode 6 or 7, we highly recommend you do so now, because in number 6, we talked about Ravi's journey in cryptocurrency as well. And in 7, we really dialed back into the basics of real estate and investing. So we highly recommend you go back and listen to that. And yeah, welcome back, Ravi.
Thanks for having me, guys. It seems like a totally different world since we last spoke.
a lot has happened. But basically, our main goal for this episode is to provide our audience with a basic understanding of the current market conditions. We're going to be talking macro economy and also concentrating on the housing market. There's been a lot that has happened in the headlines, and we really think that our audience can really benefit from understanding the fundamental factors and the things that really affect the market. And we're really going to dial everything back to really give them a real good basic understanding. Yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah, so I guess good context before we start talking about the current market is to go back to 2020. If you listen to episode 6 or 7, we shout out Ravi because he literally called the massive bull run we had in the housing market for 2 years. I rewatched the one you posted just recently, and I'll put the link in the show notes. And you put in some of the original video that you originally recorded, and you said it word for word what happened. And I don't know. I even had to call up Reese again and say, dude, I can't believe you called it perfectly. But I guess we want to, go back and discuss what caused the market to skyrocket since basically March of 2020.
Yeah, now going back like 2 years, and I remember when I was like shooting that recent video where I was using the clip from that video that I shot 2 years ago in April, and it was freaking me out as well, because I was like, I know what I felt when I was making those videos. And I knew that I had a lot of conviction around what was about to play out. Again, at the time, you know, copped a lot of hate as well, because people were like, how can you say that during a time where everyone's thinking the opposite? And it was also very risky for me to come out and say something so bold, especially when some of the experts or so-called economists and experts in the space were like, no, it's not going to happen. Because at the time, I had just started the buyer's agency as well. So Search Property, the buyer's agency, had only just set up. Mm. And so imagine if I got that wrong. You know, the next 6 or 12 months, I get obliterated. You know, people make fun of me. I got made fun of anyway, but that was in time, it played out. And now everyone's quiet, so it's funny. But, you know, looking back, you know, it's been crazy because we had basically the economy shut down. I know we spoke last year, but we still had the fear of lockdowns, which, you know, now to a certain extent is sort of alleviated. Like no one's really thinking about those things. But there's other problems now, and this was always going to happen. And what played out was very interesting, the timing of things that, you know, with the war, it's like now we can blame it on that. But the reality is when you start opening up the taps and you start having more money, people sitting at home literally making hundreds of dollars, that's not going to end well. So as much as I thought, yes, the property market's going to go up and that's great for anyone that holds property, I was saying that it was going to do that, but I hope it doesn't. Because then we wouldn't have an issue like we have now.
Yeah. And for our listeners, what kind of issue is that now?
It's inflation. And I think everyone's learning econometrics or economics 101 very quickly. They're like, what the hell's inflation? And the reality is that it was not just caused by war overseas and things like that. It was when you have more money in the supply system, that just causes the cost of goods to go up, right? At a very basic level. So now what we've got is an environment where inflation is really high, beyond technically our control because it's outside factors largely contributing to it. But then you've also got now record number of debt in the system. So when you've got debt and then you've got interest rates going up because you want to slow down how quickly the economy is moving, that debt becomes more expensive to, you know, service. And that's where I think the big issue is that everyone felt like a genius over the last 2 years with housing. But now the real, you know, the real maths or the research really comes into play, because we're going to start seeing a lot of those properties that went up are also going to give back everything they gave to a lot of people. Mm. So it's very interesting to see how people will play out the next sort of 6 to 12 months.
Yeah. Over the last 2 years, people, yeah, were sitting in their houses. Government was handing out checks left, right, and center. And that's, I guess, called fiscal policy, where the government's handing out money just basically to service people's cost of living and things like that. And also encourage people to go out and spend money on businesses to keep the economy going. On top of that, we also had a thing called quantitative easing, where essentially the government just puts money into the economy. And then that's monetary policy. So the flip side of fiscal policy. And that's kind of, yeah, as Ravi was just explaining, where we are today. We have high inflation. So the cost of living is going up. We also have interest rates going up also on the other side. So it kind of causes this squeeze where people have over-leveraged or may have over-leveraged when they were borrowing for particular mortgages. And yeah, that's where we are today.
So that's why when Ravi was talking about inflation, it's basically eroding the dollars at your purchasing power that you have. So not a good indicator, but what everyone uses is CPI. And it's basically like looking at inflation across the economy on goods that we buy. So like a basket of goods that we normally buy, and they take the average of those and see how much, it's changed over the years.
Mm.
And so it's interesting environment that we're in now and what's going on, because the government needs to start slowing things down.
And I think you can see it already translate. You know, consumer confidence is all trending down. And the reality is we've only really increased by a small amount. Like, it hasn't even been a whole percent yet.
Yeah.
You know, we've got obviously the RBA meeting tomorrow, so I'm not sure when this episode's airing. But, you know, we've got such a small change, yet you've got businesses collapsing, you've got bankruptcy, you've got construction companies collapsing, because on one hand the cost of the materials are going up, but then also their servicing costs are going up, so they can't maintain operating a business at that level. So what's going to happen is interesting, because you can't have the interest rates continue moving up. And a lot of people sort of sit there and think, oh, Ravi, you're too young, and you guys, what do you guys know, like born yesterday, interest rates are going to go up to like 17%. But because of how much debt we have in the system, it's all relative. So even a percentage move or 2% move now is like the equivalent of high interest rates back then, because the debt is so high.
Yeah. And we've heard that in a couple of podcasts as well. Like, we've never had these levels of debt ever. So like, if people try and compare it to, oh, is this like the GFC or is this like Great Depression? It's like, no, well, look how much, capital is in the market and, how much debt all these governments are in. It's not just America, it's Japan as well. And we're following suit.
So I guess before we kind of run away, and we can't wait to dive into a lot more of these like strategies and these more kind of advanced concepts, we want to kind of just do some quick fire questions so our audience can understand some of these concepts. So we'll start it off with, what does a rising cash rate actually mean? People have probably heard that all through the media. A lot of people know what an interest rate is, but what exactly is a cash rate and why does the government need to increase them now?
Yeah. So at a very basic level, the cash rate is more to do with how they're lending to like the banks and things like that. Whereas the mortgage and the interest rates are what affects us as consumers. So it's not so much focusing on what the cash rate's doing, because the banks can still increase or decrease however they like. But if you wanted to sort of understand it, it's the cost of borrowing for the banks against the RBA. Now, obviously, we're in a time now where everything digitalized. So they're not physically going, I'm going to come over, get a wheelbarrow and get some cash. It's still all digits on a computer. But usually what you'll find is when the cash rate goes up, the banks will pass that through to the customers, being people who've got mortgages. And then when they cut, that should be then translated into, passed on to the consumers, which is not always the case.
Mm.
Yeah. And for anyone, RBA is Reserve Bank of Australia as well, just to keep it basic. And basically every country has their own central bank, and that's Australia's equivalent of the of our central bank. So now we know what interest rates do and how the cash rate is related and correlated to the interest rates. In financial markets, what effects interest rates have on market sentiment and supply and demand? And you stated that before about, you know, how consumers act and they might be a bit lenient to hold on to a bit of cash. So yeah, how does that affect supply and demand when interest rates go up?
Yeah, it's a really good question. The most basic way to understand it, right? And I like to sort of break it down so it's like very logical, common sense type stuff. If interest rates go up, and the assumption is that a lot of people hold debt, whether that's credit cards, whether that's personal loans or mortgages, if the interest rate goes up, that means the economy is actually doing quite well, right? So contrary to thinking that we're up, you know, shit creek, it's actually doing quite well. Unemployment's low. We've got the economy, you know, doing well. That's why we want to increase the rates. Now, as you increase the rates, that means people have less discretionary spending towards goods and services. So suddenly, if your, you know, mortgage goes up or your mortgage repayments go up by, like, say, $200 a month, you might go, hey, you know, let's not get that coffee, or let's not go to Uber Eats and whatever. That then translates into the business making less. Now, when they make less, and then they're getting slammed on the fact that the interest rates have gone up and they may have some business loans or equipment loans and things like that, they now have the flow-on effect to go, well, okay, we can't grow our business as quickly, but it also, if it turns too quickly, they may have a position where they're actually making a loss. So that's when they start looking at layoffs, and you start seeing that happen. Now, we're already seeing that within crypto, right? Exchanges and things like that across the world. But when you see the GFC time, you saw massive layoffs across many banks. I think we may not get there, right? Depending how long they want to keep this inflation narrative as their main priority. I don't think we get there, but I think the cracks within the system start coming around because it flows on. You know, unemployment goes up. Once unemployment goes up, then basically the economy starts shutting down again, and you can't have that. So then they start doing the opposite. So right now we're doing quantitative tightening, and it was the opposite during the last 2 years, which was quantitative easing.
Yeah, exactly right. And everything that Ravi just spoke about is the flow of funds. And you think that when you look at one little aspect, you think if I change something here, it's not going to really have a massive effect. But you can, it's crazy when you really dial everything back and say, all right, well, as you said, if my mortgage rate repayments are going up, I'm not going to buy that coffee. And it just goes in this massive circle and then eventually goes back to the consumer. And not being able to, you know, have work, and that's when unemployment rises, and yeah, that's all economics. So it does get very confusing, and I think for most of our listeners, they probably don't have that experience of understanding these concepts. So yeah, this is going to be perfect.
Yeah, I think so as well. So,
and it's very much based on emotions, right? So let's say, for instance, us three have a chat now and we go, oh, look, you know, we're thinking of going out on the weekend. Suddenly we're saying, well, yeah, my repayments went up on the mortgage that I hold. So maybe instead of going to that restaurant, maybe we go to this restaurant. And we're now starting to go, what's more affordable and things like that. When we start having conversations like that, it's like a herd community, herd mentality. And that's what drives the price to go even further beyond where we think it's going to go. So it goes much lower than anyone expects it to go, and it goes much higher than anyone expects. And that's where emotions play a part.
Yeah. It's so
you can't pick it. And that's especially like, even when you try and lay out all the theory and it makes sense, you know, economic theory and how everything works, but then, you know, some policy could come in, or that's when politics can come to play. And then you can't, as we said in our last chat, we were talking about the 4-year cycle of Bitcoin, and you said historically, yes, the price changes on that 4-year cycle, but it depends really on the market, and you can't predict that. You don't know how people are going to act. You know, we're meant to say that people act rationally, but emotion gets in the way. Behavioral economics comes into play, and you can't pick it.
And doesn't that suck? Because like, it's so hard to predict anything.
Yeah.
Because like, even our first episode with Charles Tarby, who's the chairman of Century 21, he talked about basically like, I admitted that I was studying economics, and he bagged me out instantly. He's like, these damn economists are like predicting that there's going to be this big market failure. He's similar narrative to what you were saying around, no, like he basically broke it down. If you go up to a real estate agency, You see how many sold stickers are on the window versus how many are up for sale. And that's how you know whether it's a buyer's market or a seller's market, rather than looking for the headlines from these like chief economists and analysts and stuff like this, because like majority of the time they are wrong. And they're also not held accountable for being wrong either majority of the time. So it does suck that we're such behavioral beings that we just like do such random things.
It sucks on one hand because that's like the mass majority of people are looking at that, right? But then what it does is it also presents a massive opportunity, because if you know that everyone's reading that sort of stuff, they're watching the same sort of shows at 6 p.m. at night, the same narrative is being played out. All you have to do is go, well, if everyone's getting fed this, this is perfect for me because I can do the opposite and I'm going to end up doing the 1% sort of actions, which will get me those results. And that's pretty much what happened in 2020. And as we go through this episode, I'm sure we're going to figure out that my sort of thoughts on the housing market is that we're about to see round two. And in a time where everyone's like, okay, he's on something again, everything's coming out and saying the headlines are saying we're going down, I think we're about to see round two. It might just be a longer period of time before we see that, because obviously emotions play a part. But as soon as we pivot, and I'm not just saying Australia needs to pivot, the US need to pivot, because they're going to hit a recession first, which will be in the next couple of weeks. And then they also have a midterm election in November as well. So as soon as we start seeing the narrative change from there, the equities markets, the crypto market, the share market all starts, you know, getting a bit more confidence. That starts translating across into here. And that's when things get really exciting.
And I honestly got deja vu when you said the start of that and you said, whatever people are doing, I'm doing the opposite. Because you said the exact same thing in our episode last year. And you've stuck to your guns and look at the fruit it's produced for you.
It's been good. I mean, we had a lot of clients come on board as well, the buyer's agency. And, you know, it was a bit harder in terms of like trying to, because we're not really selling or convincing anyone. It was just like sharing that research. And well, the people that stuck around or that actually took the, they took the plunge during a time where end of 2021, people were like, okay, the market's gone crazy. No one's going to, you know, make any more money in real estate. It's all dead. We've literally had like clients come back, you know, over the last 3 or 4 months and they've had, you know, their equity position increased by $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. Now they're going in for their second property while people are sort of sitting there watching the headlines. Same shit's going to play out.
So let's get into it. Are we heading into a recession, Ravi?
The US, yes. And I think that will maybe flow on to Australia. But I think if we do see a recession, it'll be very quick here in Australia, right? It all depends on what the US want to do. If they want to get into a recession, well, they can't avoid it now. By the end of the year, if they don't pivot, we see ourselves in a depression. If we enter that depression world, like, you know, what could that look like? I mean, it sounds pretty dramatic, but I don't think it's really going to be that dramatic. But it's all about people associating themselves with the right debt, right productive debt, as well as assets. Because you're effectively saying that I'm still believing in the dollar, which has lost over 90% of its value over the last however many years. Mm. And for the purpose that I think assets are going to fall by 10%. Do you know what I mean? Like, it sounds pretty silly, because the truth is you can hold your asset. Like, we're holding Bitcoin. It's gone down by 70%. That doesn't feel good, right? But that Bitcoin will go up in value at some point. The currency will not. So when you see it from that perspective, it's the same thing with your assets like housing and things like that. And again, there's some projects, there's some areas that just won't come back. But that's where you need to get the right research in play.
Mm. So I guess if we're thinking that, we may be heading into, an economic downturn for the next, let's say, 6 to 12 months in Australia, there's probably two scenarios our listeners are probably playing out in their heads. First, they're either going to wait until the market corrects 15% and try time it perfectly to get in, or they've already bought a property and seen the capital growth over the past 2 years, and now it's time to sell. Talk us through, your thoughts on this, and if you're in their shoes, what would be your approach?
For our listeners, this is not financial advice as well. So Ravi doesn't know your current situation, your goals, and objectives. So just putting it out there.
100%. Everyone's risk appetite's different, right? So look, if you're buying or selling in this market, now think about it this way. When the market slows down or there's fear in the system right now, what you'll see is not only do we have less buyers in the market, so less demand, we'll also see less supply. Because if you've bought a house, why would you be selling now thinking, oh, well, It's going to go down by 10, 15%. I don't want to sell my house at a time where everyone's uncertain. I'll just wait a year. Now, you can do that if your repayments aren't so high or your cash flow isn't in crisis, where you can just hold the property. And that's what we saw in 2020 as well, where people just didn't sell because they were scared, but they were like, you know what? Supply will drop. So supply drops, demand drops, and the volume slows down. So this really starts affecting people that work in real estate, you know, whether that's buyer's agents, whether that's real estate agents, even, you know, brokers as well, because the volume drops, there's no one actually transacting. Then what happens is we see ourselves in a position where one of two things will happen, prices go up or prices go down. But what we've seen historically, and it's proven, is those who sit there and wait will be too late to pull the trigger. Because the problem with buying real estate now is that you still need to go through the process of getting a loan, getting approved for a loan, getting your due diligence done with pest and building and whatnot. And then you actually have to find the right property as well to go ahead and purchase. To align all of those things could take you the process of 6 months. Now, you could outsource that stuff and go to a buyer's agent and it fastens it up, but you still need to go through the process of getting credit, so getting a loan. So when you think about, should I wait? Should I not wait? Well, the problem is that as soon as you think the low is in or the bottom is in, guess what? 99% people are thinking the same thing. And so the quicker we go down, the quicker we have this period of, I suppose, it's a Band-Aid approach. And then we rip the Band-Aid and we start moving up fairly quickly because the FOMO starts coming in. Suddenly you've missed the bottom of the market. You're now stressing that you don't want to hit the top of the market. So that's on the buying side. When you're selling, you're sort of going, well, you need to ask yourself why you're selling. Now, if you're selling to go buy something else, well, you're probably just moving sideways because whatever's happening in your market is probably happening in the market you want to buy in. If it's an investment, I mean, you've got to really question, where are you putting that dollar? Are you selling your asset to purchase another asset? Maybe it's in a different asset class, maybe. But that's the question I would be asking. If I was selling a property now, yes, you could probably lock in some profits depending if you're in Sydney, Melbourne, and things like that. But if you've got a property in a good location that has strong cash flow and the rental crisis that we have is seeing rents increase, then I'm sort of questioning, like, why would you be selling?
Yeah. And I guess it all comes back to like how liquid the asset is. And when we say liquid, like how easily like cash can be put into it and also be released from a particular asset. We've seen in like crypto and also the stock market, it's highly liquid. There's always a buyer and a seller. So when there are these headlines and news about recessions and fear and things like that, it's harder for people to, I guess, be dramatic. And also on top of that, they don't have a ticker for the price of their home at a particular hour of a day. Unlike on the stock market where you log in, you're like, oh, I'm down 20% year to date. So it takes kind of that emotional aspect out of it, which is a really good thing because we're inherently bad investors because we're so emotional.
And I think on that point is why housing's actually done so well, even during a period where things haven't been that great. Mm. You know, the last time we sort of saw somewhat of a correction was during APRA's intervention in sort of 2017-18. That's when we really saw the market sort of slow down, which was awesome because for people, they got in at that time and they were able to reassess their positions. But also as a country, our credit system sort of had a bit of a wake-up call. And that is really good. It put ourselves in a position where banks became accountable. They didn't want to put out, you know, stupid loans, ninja loans and things like that. And we fixed the basis, the foundation. Then we moved up from there. And so when you look at, you know, the price of what real estate's done over the last 12 months, well, when you compare it to crypto and you compare it to stocks, they're two different worlds. Yeah. And I think even over the next 12 months, we're going to see more of the same. You know, even if you see, you know, real estate in some areas like your Sydney's and Melbourne's, where I do think prices will fall, even if you see a 5 or 10% drop, when you compare that to what people are losing in your crypto, your stocks and shares, like it's a huge difference. And the rebound's going to be equal, you know. To jump up 5 or 10%, all it takes is 2 or 3 extra buyers entering the market and you're back on.
Yeah. No, it's so true. In saying that, the strategy still is, I guess, long-term investing, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think for me, it's always been about that foundation. I think we covered that in that first episode, is I want to build a foundation on something that's sturdy. You know, with real estate, I focus on real estate that has not only good capital growth, but good cash flow. Mm. So I don't need to touch my income to be facilitating or making those payments to hold that property. once I have the foundation, and anyone that has the foundation means they can start taking a bit more risk. They can start investing in themselves, their businesses, and trying to take up those opportunities. You can't afford to do that if you haven't really got the foundation in.
Yeah.
You can't focus on, hey, I'm going to leave my job, go and, you know, do a startup, or I can go and create multiple streams of income when your foundation ain't strong. Because guess what? As soon as the market becomes a little volatile, you're going to fold. And I know a lot of people have done that. You know, they thought, I can get into crypto, make some, you know, returns, 3X, 5X, use that to buy real estate. And I think we saw that it's a very volatile market. You're not going to see that with, when you're preserving your cash in something like real estate as well.
And that's when you get hurt the most. And they're the people that do get hurt the most. They're forced to exit at a terrible time and, you know, can't act rationally.
Exactly. It's that forceful thing, right? So you're forced to pay those things. And that's why having the right investment strategy, understanding that, hey, you could invest in something that could potentially go up 10X, but might be worthwhile withholding some cash back.
Yeah, 100%.
It is a bit of a scary time now because we're in a low interest rate environment. We still technically are. People that did over leverage or borrow to the max during those times, it is a bit of a scary time for those people that, yeah, borrowed all the way to their capacity. But now, yeah, I guess we're getting to that point where some people may be getting squeezed.
Yeah, definitely. And you're going to see a lot of poor operators. They should fail, right? And it's bad to say, but I think I said the same thing in 2020 when I was like, if a company can't go through this period, they probably should fold. Mm. The government came out and started handing out all this money to keep all these zombie companies alive. The same thing is probably going to play out here. We're going to see rental subsidies come in. We're going to see some sort of subsidy for, you know, homeowners come in as well. They're already opening the taps up where you can get 5%, you know, no stamp duty, 5% deposits, 2% deposits. These are all things to just keep the market afloat. And they're going to keep the market afloat until we sort of get through the next phase. And then guess what? Oh, suddenly the 15% is now not downwards, it's going upwards. And we just passed the worst period of time and we just kicked the can down the road.
Yeah. Free markets are the way to go, aren't they? Like in terms of not all this intervention and as you said, like holding everything up. Sometimes it's best for the bad ones to drop off.
That relates also to the average like retail investor as well. It comes back down to that kind of greed and fear aspect. Is people have maybe been too greedy when there was a low interest rate environment and their strategy was off. And I don't know, they got too emotional and got too excited by the low interest rate environment, over leveraged. And then obviously it's a free market. So anything can kind of happen. And I guess that's where people have to take the time and kind of revisit that strategy, educate themselves, whether that's through podcasts or through professionals, and kind of revisit that strategy and take this as a learning opportunity as well.
Yeah, for sure. It's so easy to come up with the best case scenarios. Maybe we should be preparing for the worst. Hope for the best, but prepare for the worst.
Mm.
If inflation is eating away our savings and the markets are down, what should we be doing with our cash? Where should we deploy our capital and where should we invest? And obviously, again, this is not financial advice, but what would you be doing, Ravi?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think you've still got to keep those investing muscles active, right? So let's take it a step back. If you suddenly were, you know, you're playing sport, you were constantly working out your muscles, you're going to the gym and whatnot, and then suddenly you got a bit of an injury. Now, you could take the opportunity to go, well, I'm just going to sit on the couch, continue eating what I was eating, and then you're probably going to put on weight, probably not feeling so great. But if you have, say, your arm that's got injured, but you can still, you know, hop on a bike, exercise bike, or you can go for walks and things like that, you're probably still better off doing that, but within your capacity. And I think investing is the same. I think we're in a period where, yes, you could probably put in money now, and tomorrow you wake up and it's probably less, you know, in terms of value. So I think it's a matter of being very careful about how you deploy cash, but always having a large portion of your cash also saved during this period. Now, this period is probably going to be short-lived. I don't think it's going to be like drawn out for 5 or 10 years. I think it's a short period of time where, you know, for myself, I'm about to buy more real estate than I've ever bought before. I'm taking on more debt than I've ever taken on before. And when it comes to like things like crypto, which I've been very transparent on the YouTube channel about, which is that I'm holding a lot of cash back, but I'm also still DCAing in because I don't know when the bottom is. And will I be sad if in 3 months from now it's down another 50%? No, I won't, because my goal is not to see where it's in 3 months' time. I want to see where it's in 5 to 10 years' time. Mm-hmm. And I believe the prices will be higher for most assets, quality assets, in 10 years' time. So I still want to be active in this market. And all it takes is a few pivots, a few changes in our monetary system, or a few announcements to get made before the market turns. We saw it in 2020. It doesn't take a lot to move this market. And this time is different in the sense that we've seen a two-speed economy over the last couple of years. So the rich got richer, the poor got poorer. That's the game, right? The rich, the smart money's buying, but they're not going all in. Like for me, the amount of money I'm putting in now is very different to what I was putting in, say, 12 months ago when it comes to crypto. So that's how I would probably attack it in the next couple of months.
Yeah, and that's like the perfect strategy. For our listeners, DCA means dollar cost averaging into the market, and not trying to time it at the lowest. It's just buying, think of just like a bell curve in your head, starting low and going high. You're buying each point along that curve. And that could be on like a weekly basis or fortnightly basis, whatever suits you best. And that's just trying to not time the market, but basically, as we always say, and everyone says, it's about the time in the market, counts and how long you're in there for.
And it's so true what you said. It's not hard to move this market, and bringing it back to real estate as well. A lot of people that we know, especially because we were at the age of like around 20, they were buying their first like properties, and they happened to buy it like the perfect time. It seemed like to be the perfect time. They saw that awesome capital growth over that time, but it's just the fact that they were in the market at that time. Mm-hmm. It's not like they actually, unlike you who studies like the macroeconomics and kind of understood that at a deeper level, they just happened to be in the market. So there is sort of like, you've got to put yourself out there to reap the benefits, and you can't just live in fear, because obviously we're young. We have a long-term horizon in front of us. If you're just going to think that the market's going to go down forever, you may as well move out to a small country town, buy a plot of land and kind of hide away there, buy gold. But I think like a lot of opportunity coming up in the future as well. But you've got to be in the market to kind of reap those benefits. DCAing and all of those other strategies are perfect.
And what an exciting time.
Yeah.
Like look where we are, 22 years old and where the market's at now. It's opportunity.
Mm.
And like, this is a great opportunity for anyone to, do your research, do your due diligence, and really look into this, because it's a great opportunity across the board to be in the environment we're in.
100%. I mean, the only point I'll add to that, because you guys have put it together so well, is would you rather have, financial freedom achieved 2 years earlier or 2 years later? And you both say 2 years earlier, obviously. But if I said, well, if you waited an extra 2 years, your net worth will probably be worth 3x to 5x more. Now, would you still want it 2 years earlier? And, because we're young, we'd go, well, I'll take the 2 years later now. Yeah. And that's pretty much what we see, because the markets have sort of capitulated. For the next 18 months, they're probably not going to even come close to the levels they were at before. So that just means you kick the can down the road for 2 years. You're making money. You're still, securing good assets at a cheaper price. And then when the market returns, because everything's cyclical, we will have, times where the Fed will cut rates again. And I believe that probably happens sooner than later. I would not be surprised. It's probably, putting it out there again. But within the next 18 months, I think we see the RBA cut their first rate. It's their first rate cuts. And so can you imagine what happens when, at the moment, we're increasing at such a rapid pace and the market's still going up? So then people will say, okay, well, it takes time for these things to play out. When interest rates go up, it doesn't have an immediate effect. And I'll say, well, what have banks been doing for the last 12 months? They've been increasing rates, right? So if they've been increasing rates for the last 12 months and the prices are still going up, people are just looking for an excuse to say, oh, no, the prices will still continue going down. And it's the same shit we heard. When JobSeeker ends, the market's going to collapse. Or when JobKeeper ends, it's going to collapse. The housing pause, the pause repayments, that once that ends, everyone's going to be screwed. When the lockdowns are going to come in, oh, we're going to be screwed. Nothing played out. Mm. And so this constant living in fear, thinking the market's going to be wrong. Yeah, at some point we're going to correct, right? I just don't think we're going to see the big correction of 20, 30% that, we're seeing headlines suggest.
Yeah. And we listened to a podcast, we studied billionaires, and they had a recent episode that talked about, their Bitcoin Maximus, and they had a real macro level discussion, and they talked about how the Fed Reserve, like, they have to, in order for these central banks there to do what they want to do, they have to increase rates to a certain level that we can chop it back and then have the effects on the economy that they want. So, you know, as you just said, you're thinking 18 months where they're going to have rising the interest rates and then able to cut it back to have that effect.
Yeah, correct. I mean, it's either they increase it and hope the economy doesn't shit itself. Mm-hmm. So let's say they go from, you know, at the moment, if our cash rate is 0.85, let's say they get up to 2, right? So a whole 1 and a bit percent, they get to 2%. Now, the next part of this will be, okay, demand destruction's occurred. Everything's like, no one wants to do anything. Then they start cutting rates. And let's say they go from 2 down to 1.2. Now, that's going to feel a lot better. And it's the same as prices go up and they come back down to the same levels. You're like, oh, it doesn't feel as great.
Yeah.
But if they can't increase, and this is what I'm sort of, you know, doing numbers on, is if they can't increase to a point where the economy starts shitting itself and it breaks down and they don't get to their 2 number, right, whatever that number is, then the only other option you have is when you drop it next time, you have to go negative, right? And you go negative interest rates. And so I think that's still on the table. I think it's going to happen at some point. It's not a good thing. There's winners and losers in every game. And I think we're going to see that proportion of people that invested well, had the right research and were actually active are going to reap the rewards, whereas some people just don't have that opportunity.
Yeah. So going back to when we first really broke it all down and we talked about how we had those 2 scenarios, there are probably those type of people that have, you know, over-leveraged themselves, made the most of the low interest rate environment. And they're probably looking at the news right now and you're freaking out. You've obviously kind of eased their minds in terms of talking about your personal strategy of you're going to buy up, you know, don't freak out. This is a long-term strategy, you know, long-term time horizon. What other little tips and pieces of advice would you tell them basically to ease their mind on this?
I would say number one is have the right strategy. If that means you need to get people around you that know what they're doing, I would much rather, like, think about it with common sense. I'm listening right now to the same economists that got it wrong 2 years ago, and there have been plenty that have been wrong even before that. They don't actively sit there and look at markets or actually actively go and talk to agents and, you know, see what loan deals are being done. They simply sit there, look at a bunch of numbers, and they go, oh, that's what I think is going to happen, right? Now, we also don't know, is there a play there by, you know, and this is the tinfoil sort of conspiracy thing, is have they been told to say such outlandish numbers? Because if they just say those things are going to happen, it's going to slow down and have an effect that maybe the RBA doesn't actually have to increase their rates as quickly because now everyone's scared, right? So there's a lot of things at play. And I would just go have people around you that are actually active in this market that know what they're talking about and stop listening to the rubbish, right? And that could be, I literally went, you know, I had a trip recently to the Gold Coast and the Uber driver was telling me and giving me advice on, you know, what he thinks the property market's going to do. And obviously, I didn't tell him I've got a YouTube channel or anything like that. So I just went along with it. And it's funny because last year, I had the same thing happen when, you know, our concierge down where we stay in our apartment block, he was saying like, oh man, like, I can't wait till property prices are dropping, you know? And this was mid last year. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, why do you think that's going to happen? And he was like, oh man, like, it's all over the news. Everyone knows it. And, you know, we're making the same mistakes and we make it all the time. So have the right people around you, have the right strategy, outsource it if you need to, because one mistake, and that's the part that, you know, we plan for the worst as well, right? Is if you make one mistake in real estate, it's leveraged. So as much as we talk about leverage returns on the upside, think about the downside at a leverage level. And I know plenty of people that have bought in Sydney and Melbourne and they go, oh no, it's blue chip and all that rubbish, right? Interest rates went up, so their cash flow went to shit. Now they can't sell because now their properties are worth less than what they bought it for 6 months ago. Whoop-de-doo, right? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that's 101 of not listening to the right people. So yeah, it's tough if you're in that position.
And it does come down, like at the start, when we talked about Charles Talbot looking at the window of your local real estate firm. And it is true, like that's that first-hand information. It's not just analyzing the numbers. It is looking at, what would you call that? Like,
it's like primary data, right?
Yeah, like, and like real hands-on kind of what's actually going on, the fundamental stuff.
Correct. It's very micro, right?
Yeah.
You think these economists sit there and go, oh, there's like 20,000 markets. I'm going to go like find out every market. No. Yeah. There's some markets like in Sydney that are actually growing at the moment, but there's others that aren't growing. And for me, obviously, for our clients, we look at more so other states and other regional markets. And over there, if you go there and you say, oh, well, the prices are coming down everywhere, everyone's scared, they're going to say, well, okay, don't buy this property. It's going to be sold tonight. And that's what we're seeing. This competition's still there. People are still buying. And it's so affordable when you see it relative to the rents that people are paying, the cash flow that you're able to get. People are going to figure this out. Most people have access to the same data, right? So if everyone's got access to it, then the same results should occur. Mm. And that's where those primary indicators, talking to people on the ground floor, is going to make a huge difference.
Yeah. And from that podcast as well, that episode, and We Study Billionaires, they talked about in the GFC, and this guy was traveling around. He went interstate to this place, don't even know where, talking to the taxi driver. And the taxi driver was saying, oh yeah, like, you know, I've got 6 properties. And this guy's sitting in the back thinking, what do you mean? And he's like, yeah, I got 6 properties. Like, and back then, obviously down payments probably like 1%, not either. Yeah. And that's just kind of like firsthand knowledge that you can see, and things don't line up and don't make sense. And you can, that, as you said, it's common sense at the end of the day. You can think, well, wait a minute, taxi driver have 6 properties. How does that work? And what can this actually cause, and what effect would it have?
So true. Sometimes like the simplest answer is like the truest answer, right?
Yeah.
Rather than all of this jargon over the from banks.
Yeah, yeah. People get like analysis paralysis, right? There's so much information. Like, this can do this and this can do this. And the biggest advice I got 9 years ago, literally, right? Like, take it down, is if you can get a mortgage today, go and get it. And I was like, oh, okay. And that I've always held, right? Like, and I bought property even before APRA came in and all that shit went, you know, down, and it wasn't a great time. But now I'm sitting going, I'm glad I made those moves, because now it's actually harder to get a loan for X amount of property than it was back then, despite interest rates being higher. So that's where, you know, I talk about this, where people think that, oh, just by waiting and you get the right price and whatnot, or they go to the broker and say, I want to get the lowest interest rate. What you need to find out is how you get the solution to the problem you have, which is, I want to buy assets and I want to get the right loan product to help me get that. Mm. It's not about the price. It's about how do you accumulate those assets over time. And if you suddenly have interest rates drop, let's say they drop to 1%, right, in 3 years' time, and everyone's going, oh, it's going to be amazing, I can buy property then. Or when property prices have come down by 20%, what's the guarantee the banks are even going to give you a loan to buy a property? And so that's the problem we're going to find, is people sort of wait, and they go, oh shit, the government changed the rules, I can't buy.
Yeah, it's so true. And also, property is one of those things where you can lean on your equity. So it's not just like you're buying, like you have one down payment and then that buys your property. Like, you can leverage your property, and that is how you accumulate a real estate portfolio at the end of the day. So it's not really, it is a different game to a lot of other markets, where rather than just buying like one for one, you can leverage your debt to get another property. And that is the game of real estate, I guess, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think my first deposit acted as the deposit, because the equity, you know, grew in that first property to then end up buying me 3 or 4 after that. Mm. And so it's just, if you understand the rules of the game, it becomes quite simple. But, you know, this whole process, it sounds so simple, right? Just buy one and then you wait 12 months, buy another one and you keep adding. Right? It's simple, but it ain't easy. Right. And that's where you need to have the right people around you to know, okay, I've been there before, I know how to get there again.
I love what you just said. And this is something that Jamin Fraser, we had him on the show. He's the founder of the Insecurity Project. And he has a really great podcast. He put out a podcast recently about the rules of the game. And it kind of relates back to this like analysis paralysis type idea. When you break it down, you figure out what game you're playing. Let's say it's real estate. In each game, there's a set of rules. Like, and you figure out what those rules are. You get the right people around you. And once you've done that, you've broken it down. You understand what the rules are to win the game. Because at the end of the day, as much as people want to say, oh, no, it's not everything's about winning. At the end of the day, it is about winning, I guess. Like when you drop everything else, you want to win the game, especially if it's real estate. And it kind of puts away all of that other mess and information that is no longer relevant because you understand the rules and you can kind of execute from there.
Yeah. And then to add into that, he also talks about like, then it comes down to, well, who do I need to be to win that game? And that's where the insecurity thing comes into it. Cause it's like, well, if I actually need to, you know, get a mortgage out, I'm going to have to work a bit harder and, you know, earn a bit more, maybe work two jobs, work at a nightclub, get that extra cash so I can service my mortgage repayments.
Yeah.
And then once you got all that sorted, then you know how to win the game.
Mm.
Easy as that.
I love it. You know, I don't want to win. You know, it's not about winning. It's like, bro, you wake up in the morning, you better hope you're winning that day. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, exactly.
So to take it all back and talk about it, your strategy, obviously long-term strategy wins. Think about long-term strategy. Get your foot in the door early, or whenever you can, as early as you can, get your foot in the door and try and build up hard assets that you can build your foundation on. And then once you've done that and build your foundation, then you can start playing the game really to your benefit and taking those risks. Because when you don't have that foundation, that's when you're going to have to take early exits and you're going to have to get hurt when, you know, there's changes in interest rates and you can't service loans and that's when it just slippery hill.
Yeah.
And anything else to add into that, Ravi, that just to kind of refresh everything?
No, I think that's good, man. I mean, apart from that, then you've just got normal money habits, right? You know, don't spend money you don't have, that sort of shit. And I think right now, if you have the time, everyone can make time for this, is, you know, you try and learn about, you know, your health, you try and learn about other things and people and whatnot. Spend some time, you know, get your financial literacy up, you know, whether it's podcasts, books, there's so many opportunities out there now. It's sort of silly that, you know, when I have a conversation over the weekend, I had a conversation with someone and they were like so oblivious to some of the stuff that was happening. I'm like, where are you spending your time? And they're like, oh, just, you know, like Instagram and shit. And I'm like, that's why, you know, people lose. And unfortunately, you know, you're not here to try and change those things. All you can do, and that's what you're doing with the podcast, I do with the YouTube channel, is you try and put it out there, hope a couple of people listen, and then even less than that will act on it. Awesome. You're putting out the good energy out there.
Yeah.
And as you said, build your circles out. Like, that's what's most important, the people around you. And like, hold yourself accountable, like have these conversations, maybe organize a weekly coffee with your mates that are really dialed into this and really want to grow and want everyone around them to grow, because that's the only way that you're going to get ahead is if like you have people around and you're talking to mates that are interested in this space. Like, that's what I'm really grateful for. Ben, you know, we can have these conversations and talk about these high level things where like, other than that, you know, we spend a lot of time at work, but there might not be people at work that really want to talk about these things. You know, family members probably not really interested. So yeah, just really try and nail in on that circle.
Mm.
And, you know, as that saying always, like, you are the people around you is who you're going to be in the future, yeah, kind of thing. So, you know, have the best people around you that can support and help each other grow.
Mm.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's the average of the five people you hang out with.
Yeah.
And I think as I've gone through my 20s, I'm almost 30 now. So next month I'm turning 30. And I literally look back into my 20s and I'm like, I can see the evolution of me and my mindset as to what I was doing at the time as well with the five people I most spoke to at the time. Mm. And your group of people become so close-knit with people that you actually get along with and have similar goals that are aligned. And I think it's so true.
So I guess we kind of touched on this, but in these times where I guess the media is pushing these narratives about major recessions, I guess like the bear markets are end all bear markets, the death of the fiat currency, everything like that, I think it's really important to kind of take a step back and take a long-term view on the market. As a lot of our listeners are in their 20s, we have a long-term, I guess, horizon ahead of us. And we kind of touched on it before, there's a lot of opportunity in the market. And sometimes it's time to kind of flick off that TV or that computer screen, go for a walk. I don't know, maybe even just educate yourself on different things. Keep that investing muscle going, just like you've said. So I guess, can you talk us through why we should be looking forward to the future and why real estate is a good long-term investment?
Yeah, I think when it comes to real estate, think about it from this perspective. You've got construction companies, you know, some of them, a lot of them are struggling with cash flow issues and some have now announced that they're, you know, they're collapsing. You then have people not, you know, wanting to spend more, you know, taking on loans, construction costs have gone up, so they're going to have to borrow more as well. They can't build their homes. you're going to have a big supply issue, right? And it's already happening. You've got a rental crisis where, you know, literally properties are going up by 60, 70 bucks a week in terms of rent overnight, right? Like it's happening very quickly. You've got people around the country that are having to live in caravans, their cars, on their couch and things like that. So it's pretty bad. It's about to get worse. And that's because when supply will actually come back into, you know, coming into the system, let's say it happens in 12 months' time, you can't just, you know, turn and flick on a switch and suddenly all of the construction's coming back in. It takes time to build these things. It takes time to get approved. So the flow-on effect of this is going to be massive over the next sort of 3 years. And I think the supply issue is going to be then compounded with huge levels of demand when you start getting immigration come in, because that really hasn't picked up yet. We've got a supply shortage in the country, and that's why some people are getting offered jobs for, you know, which they shouldn't be getting offered jobs for and getting paid a shitload, because we have a supply shortage of good quality workers. When we start promoting the fact that immigration is important for us, those people are going to have to come and rent somewhere, or they're going to have to live somewhere. So suddenly it becomes more about a supply and demand of shelter rather than I just want to make some money on the side. And that's why I find that my foundation being built on something that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years makes a lot more sense to me. And then it's all compounded on the fact that, you know, interest rates at max could go up maybe 2% from here. After that, the economy has bigger problems than the housing market collapsing. The government's basically imploding at that point. You've got banks out of business at that point. So when I look at that and I see the trickle-down effect, to me, it makes more sense to take up more productive debt against good cash flow assets. And even if in the next year or 2 years, I don't see any growth in those assets, I still get a shitload of cash flow. And when I get that cash flow, that gives me confidence I can stay in this market. I can then use that to dollar cost average into higher risk assets like Bitcoin, Ethereum. And when the market returns, I then get to take out that equity and keep building again. So that's where I'm about.
And I honestly had no clue about the renters like market until a mate recently tried moving up to Newcastle, and there's actually people called renters agents. And there's actual people out there that literally they're like real estate agents, but look for rental properties. And basically what they do is like scope out rental properties. They have obviously relationships with,
homeowners
and everyone like that. And then in order like for the payment, they take like a week's rent or like 2 weeks rent or whatever, which is like unbelievable. Like when do these things exist? And that just goes to show like how hard it is to find rental property.
And that's like pretty much with buyer's agents, you know, like 3 years ago, no one's even heard of it in Australia. Mm. Now there's a lot, you know, you probably get targeted on Facebook with ads and Instagram ads and shit. But the reality is, because it's so difficult to buy good quality assets without getting screwed over, that's where buyer's agents came in. And they were like, well, we do research full time. And that's the reason why dentists exist, because you can't operate on your own teeth, or doctors exist and mechanics exist. Yeah, I'm not surprised by the whole rental agents. I've heard about that too. And it's going to be a growing industry, that one, because shit's about to get hard.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking. Like these guys are on a mint, especially if, you know, you have those, you build those relationships and you know, and especially for people moving to other jurisdictions and moving in a state, it's like you don't have that time to actually be on the floor and having a look around, going to open homes and things like that. But so
especially with like these migrants that are coming from overseas, like they have no idea what the housing market's like. They're just like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's like you need a shelter over your head at the end of the day before you can start thinking about anything. So that's their first priority. I really love that you brought that up. That's something that I've never really thought about. And it brings it back to that supply demand, especially with lower construction because they aren't able to service their debt or borrow money easily.
It all goes around. It all goes around.
It goes around. And you know what? And I was saying this as well, was when rates start inevitably moving up, and I was saying this about 12 months ago, I said, when they start moving up, and they will, when they move up, the economy is going to start shaking, right? People are going to get shaken out. And then the government needs to step in and be like, hey, okay, we've done enough. Let's turn it back, right? But before that, as the rates increase, the rents will increase. And the reason for that is, well, homeowners are going to go, well, there's not as many people buying now because they can't afford to buy because their borrowing capacity fallen, right? Now, if they can't buy and they need to live in that area, guess what? They have to rent. Now there's not enough rental properties. So guess what? The prices go up. Do you know what I mean? And the flow-on effect happens where then the government says, well, we need more people to buy houses so they can live somewhere. Guess what they announced? The 2% deposits, equity schemes, and things like that. And the circle keeps going around and around.
Crazy, eh? So I guess like we can't really end this interview without talking about opening it up and kind of talking about crypto and all of these other type of things, because a lot has happened. As you said in the beginning of the interview,
oh my God,
we're in an entirely different market. And yeah, it's crazy. I want to start by asking you, what's something that you've learned over the past 2 years? That can be in any market or even like in your own personal life. Over the past 2 years, obviously we've gone through a lot of change. And yeah, and I'll give you a minute to kind of have a think.
I would say my biggest learning has been, it, you know, be careful who you listen to. And on top of that, you won't go broke taking profits, right? So, crypto had promised the world to a lot of people, right? And I expected prices to go a lot higher than they did as well. And so when you go through that process and you start thinking about logically, am I able to get a 10% return anywhere else? Maybe. But when you start talking about 100% return in like the period of 6 months, it's just smart to take some chips off the table. It doesn't matter if it goes 5x from there. And I think that's a big lesson for all three of us, right? Being involved in that market, that even when we see the prices, go up, it's the opposite of what happens now. It's we buy and the prices drop tomorrow, right? When we are going to be in a bull market and there's greed everywhere, we're going to sell and the prices will go up tomorrow. Yep. So it's just mentally being okay with that happening. And if we're okay with stomaching those returns and, you know, the price going up, we dollar cost average as we sell as well. So I think that's probably been my biggest learning. Is this the same for you guys as well?
Yeah. So like I was going to say, it's definitely been the biggest big learning for me. Obviously, I bought first in the market 2020, like May or so. So I saw like from the beginning when like Bitcoin was, I think it was like $10,000, rode it all the way up. And then I guess I got greedy, and like that was the thing. And it's a massive learning for me. And I remember listening to a podcast kind of midway through that period and talks about keeping a journal around like how you're feeling in particular times in the market. And that's something that I did over, I guess the market started to kind of fall from November of 2021 and then all the way through to kind of where we are now. And I've kind of just kept a journal of how I was feeling when I was feeling great, when the market was going up, and it was kind of that over greed. I was excited, like thought there's nothing, like, I don't know. I just was so confident in my ability, even though it's stupid. Like
I'm invincible, baby.
Yeah, I know. And I kind of took note of like how I was feeling at that time, because I know that that's an indicator as to maybe I should take some chips off the table at that time. And then also, do you remember in, I guess it was May of 2021, where we had that market crash and then we kind of came back up in November, feeling pretty down on myself. So like, and making note that maybe it is a good time to hold as well, kind of like keeping track of your emotions.
And it really does like play effect on you. I remember that time, because you obviously had, you deployed a lot more capital than I did. And I was just kind of just riding it. And it really did affect you on a personal level. Like we would come and work on the podcast and it would just be like a bit dull.
It's true.
And it kind of, you can see how it can ruin relationships with like your loved ones and people around you, because you're talking well and hard earned money at the end of the day. And like that can be detrimental, and you've got no responsibilities. Oh. Like you got nothing to worry about. And then think about someone who, you know, is providing for a family and, you know, just bought their first property and dipping in with this stuff. Like that can get really messy really quick.
And especially people that like maybe don't educate themselves as much as we do, or kind of have this broader knowledge. Like obviously we still make mistakes, but we're lucky to even have that and also not have responsibility in saying that. Like there's a lot of people that kind of just jump straight into the market, maybe not even telling their wife or telling their family and getting absolutely destroyed.
Oh, I think there's so many memes online about that sort of stuff, but the reality is it's true, right?
Yeah.
And you're 100% right around the journal part. Something cool that we do is like in our Patreon community, I usually do like a weekly audio session, right? So it's like a 10, 15 minute breakdown of the markets, how I'm feeling, the things happening. And so I've got one for like basically every week or every second week since July last year. And so it's very interesting even for me, like just to be able to download those and at some point go through it for the next market and just continue running the Patreon community to go, you know, there was a time that this shit was like amazing. And I talk about NFTs and I talk about, you know, like the prices back then. I've got WhatsApp messages that I've saved now. And I'm like, oh, you know, went up by like, you know, 0.2 ETH. And you look back and you're like, that was nothing compared to where it is now. Or it was so much more I should have sold at that point and come back. So I like that, man. You've got to have a journal. You've got to learn that stuff. And with crypto, what you'll find is everyone makes money on their second cycle because they have to go through the whole thing, right? So as much as it feels like shit, I probably caught the last end bit of last cycle. And I remember just portfolio going down. I'm like, this feels very similar to, you know, the last 3-4 months now. So you just, you know, that the next couple of years are going to feel like crap. Accumulate wealth, don't walk away from the market. And I think those who stay and stick with the market will do exceptionally well in about, you know, 7 or 8 years.
Yeah. And something that I really look forward to now is because we're kind of in this downturn, is dollar cost averaging in rather than putting like a lump sum of capital in, because it takes that emotional side out of it so much more. So I actually look forward to like, yeah, just putting $400 a week into the market.
Damn.
Because like that's no longer kind of like I've calculated that on, I've done a very simple formula on Excel.
Sophisticated formula, Excel sheets and shit.
Equal sum, sell, minus sell.
I've ran a quick regression line. That looks honestly.
Yeah. So it's like something that money's no longer, I guess, not emotional when I put it in.
Yeah.
I think that's the only way to do it. And you know what's going to feel great is for anyone that bought in, say, 2018 and 2019, when they saw everyone just piling in 2021, they're probably not even buying. They're just selling. They're like, this is fantastic. Same thing's going to probably play out for us over the next 5 years where we accumulate for the next couple of years, come back and, you know, it'll be interesting to see where we are in 12 months' time from now. We're probably still going to be in a bear market, I think, but I think the emotions will have changed in that market, you know, not just with crypto, but everything else, which is going to be cool.
Yeah, I think so as well.
And for any listeners, like as we said in our last episodes with you, we highly recommend you go listen to Ravi on YouTube. It's just at Ravi Sharma, isn't it?
Yeah. So personal finance with Ravi Sharma. If they just type in my name, Ravi Sharma, it'll come up as well.
And there's so many good updates there. And also the all Patreon community. I had a couple mates that joined after our episode.
Wow, cool.
And yeah, they really like they just couldn't stop talking about it. They said how good it was. And they're all two guys that weren't really not heaps educated with the whole personal finance thing. So like they thought it was perfect. Like I think they got onto one of the $60 plan or something like that. And they honestly said it's like well worth more than that in terms of what they got out of it. Because, you know, if you don't have the time to search these things and to be on the market and to look at the history and look at all the data, like you have to honestly, if you want to win at this game, like you need something more than that. And they really said that subscription was well worth it.
That's awesome, man. It's good to hear. And I think that's the whole point, right? Like, you know, not everyone has friends like yourselves where you can talk about this stuff. You don't have people around you that are constantly sort of, you know, keeping you accountable. And that was the whole idea about the Patreon community was, you know, having conversations, asking questions. How can you be in that same environment with other people? And suddenly you start networking with those people and, you know, anything's possible. But just being in the right conversations, I know for myself, you know, when I first discovered crypto, I first discovered those particular altcoins. I know we had chats about the metaverse and things like that. So, you know, just being in those right conversations at the right time is a bigger difference versus, you know, the guarantee of you not actually being in those conversations is 100% if you aren't putting yourself out there.
Yeah, 100%. So they're the two places that you can find Ravi. And highly recommend go to those places and also on Instagram, personal finance at Ravi Sharma. But be careful of all those spam accounts because, man, they've been messing you up. I swear to God.
The double
underscore personal finance, the personal finance underscore.
I think they've tried everything now. And I've had close mates come back and they're like, oh, yeah, cool. We were chatting last night. I'm like, no, I didn't DM you, bro.
I got this DM from one of them. It was like, oh, do you want to do business together or something like that? I was like, oh, shit.
We're on. So if you see any links, don't click on them.
Yeah, no, it's a good call out, man. It's super annoying, but unfortunately, there's nothing that we can really do unless I got verified, which would be nice. But yeah, it's a fair bit away. Yeah,
no, but we really thank you so much for coming on once again. And as we always talk about, we should make this a reoccurring thing and really catch up, because it's so interesting to see, you know, we've been able to build that relationship and to see how much you have grown. And you're constantly just always killing it, like always doing a great job.
No, I appreciate it, guys. And the only reason I come back on is because I like catching up with you guys, hanging out with you guys. And even for, you know, the conversations we were having back then versus now, there's so much that's changed in your lives, which has been cool. So yeah, looking forward to the next one, bro.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you want to stay up to date with what's new, remember to press follow on your chosen podcast platform.
You can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn at Young Opportunist. Once again, thanks for listening.
Catch you next time.